ngai iwi o te motu mai, tēnā rā koutou, tēnā na hoki koutou, e whakarongo mai nā ki te reo o te mana Māori. In tonight's program, we enter the realm of Tangaroa, the god of the oceans.
Unuhia, unuhia, ko te pumua, ko te putapu, ko te puna, te rongo mai whiti, te whakarango nā, kenei ngatolo ka hika, ki te pumua, ki te putaha, ki te pou, te wharau, ahe aturangi mama. Tugua te a i tukolongo ko te rongo na ruarangi inunga turuturu me ko oho te taina kauraka me ko ihu maraku te tugua atu ki te ara nōrua. Heke heke i o hara ta keke whara te ara o ngā toro he ara whanu ki te pō mā te whaiariki. Pera hoki rā ko te ara o ngā toro. Eke, eke, eke tangaroa eke panuku. Uie, taeke.
That was a karakia to Tangaroa, recited by Paora Te Muera of Te Arawa. It's an invocation that will give us sanction to speak about aspects of Tangaroa's vast domain, Te Moana Nui Ākua. In view of New Zealand's interest in the new 200-mile fishing zone, it seems logical that various fishing ventures should be undertaken to tap the vast resources of fish. George Habib, a fisheries scientist with the Department of Fisheries, believes that a scheme involving Māori fishing expertise should be set up to do just this.
If you look at the, once again I repeat the potential fish catch, which is up to 1 million tonnes of fish per year, and we now look at the present New Zealand fish catch, which is about 50,000 tonnes. Foreign fleets have taken substantially more than that in the last few years. So the potential is obviously there. My feeling as a Maori person who has a general Maori background is that the Maori people who, in my estimation, have a historical connection with the sea, a historical or mythological or whatever way you'd like to put it. My feeling is that the Maori people should think seriously about moving into this industry, which is ripe, ready for the taking. In my dealings with the various Maori groups in the last 2 or 3 years, I've come across this concept of Maori land and corporations, which are organisations which seem to me to be able to lay their hands on considerable sums of money, which are necessary to buy the necessary material to exploit the fisheries resources. My feeling is that instead of spending this money on vast tracts of pine trees, maybe these people would be better to put their money into fishing boats and go fishing and pursue the fishing industry as a tribal group, where they can have catching on the water and processing ashore in coastal communities, where all the Maori people are involved in the job, and be doing at the same time something which is traditional to the Maori people.
If we were to look at the land resettlement schemes and the initial setting up of some of the land incorporations, it was very much at the initiation of a person like Sir Apiranga Nata. This sort of scheme that you're talking about in relation to the sea, are we to wait around for an innovator such as Upi, or do we need to do something in a more collective way?
Well, like much progress which is which is based on something which is completely new to people, you do need, you do often need an innovator to bring the thing, to put the idea to people. You need somebody who feels strongly about this whole, this new idea, and somebody to take it to the people and sell it to them. And that's about what you need, yes.
Now, with the recent reshuffling of the Department of Māori Affairs, they've set up a directorate for Marae projects. Can you see any relation between what you have in mind and this newly created sector of Māori Affairs?
Yes, well, maybe this is where the direction has to come from some government-type body which can see the issues on a broader basis. And maybe this is where it has to start, yes.
Can you just perhaps point out some of the areas that would need to be looked at if the Māori people were to adopt this type of idea?
Well, it seems to me that there's very little in the fishing industry that the Māori people cannot be very good at. For instance, this whole business of mussel farming is getting off the ground throughout New Zealand. Mussel farming, oyster farming, mussel farming particularly, a particularly new field of endeavour, and one's quite suited to Māori coastal communities in the vicinity of the east coast of the North Island, for instance. The technology involved isn't all that great. The initial amount of money which is required isn't all that very much. But it does need to be followed up with the right type of processing and marketing after the crops are harvested. So any form of marine farming is certainly very adaptable to Māori coastal communities. You take, on the other hand, the fishing operations which involve various fishing craft, the bottom trawlers, for instance. Throughout New Zealand, we have a scattering of Māori people crewing these vessels, often running them for Pākehā companies. There is a good deal of expertise, Māori expertise, throughout the fishing industry. The lobster boats are another example. These little vessels scattered around New Zealand, where you have individual Māori people making an awful lot of money from a fishery. The oyster fleet in Faubo Strait, and so on. There are tremendous openings, and we already have a good number of Māori people in the industry. A field in which I'm presently involved is purse seining. This is a type of surface fishing for surface schooling fishers. There are two or three boats that operate in the Bay of Plenty, which are partly crewed by Māori people. So we have the expertise there. This is a very large, this field has a very large potential. And so in my estimation, there's very little in the fishing industry that should hold any difficulties for the Māori people if they want to move into it in a big way.
From previous experiences, if one was to look at the establishment of the crayfishing factory up at the east coast there, now one comment that was said to me was that, sure, the Māoris provide the labour force in that they do the fishing for the crays and they do the sort of factory floor type work within the factory, but when it comes to actual management and distribution and marketing, there's normally a Pākehā involved. So how does one involve Māoris in that area of an industry?
Well, there are a number of Māoris who are in this aspect of the industry, and even if there aren't, or even if there aren't enough, the Māori business, or whatever you might call it, that is running a particular aspect of exploitation in the fishing industry could employ the right types of people until they had time to train up their own people to do the job.
So the sort of scheme that you have in mind is a cooperative, very similar to the land incorporations, but based on farming the sea.
Yes, I think initially that's the way it could get going, although eventually the industry could be dominated by Maori people right throughout New Zealand in the same way that we have the Pākehā people doing it presently. Yes, I think initially it could start out as on a cooperative basis, but then spread throughout the industry. We have individual people doing their own thing as Maori groups, maybe employing Pākehā people where necessary, and spreading throughout the industry and to a stage where it becomes the fishing industry becomes a Maori thing.
The Maniapoto voices singing the popular Kingi Tahiwi composition, E Tiwi E. Our first speaker was George Hubbard, a member of the Ngāti Tūwhare Toa people, who's one of only two young Māori men who have specialised in the study of marine life. The other is Michael Walker of the Whakatohia tribe of the East Coast. Michael Walker, who's currently studying at the East West Centre in Hawaii, completed his master's degree with a study on the kina. Here he talks to Selwyn Mudu about this Maori delicacy.
You specialise in the good old kina. Last year you gave a paper at an important conference on Kaimoana. Could you tell us something about the habits and life history of the kina?
Well, the kina is, or sea urchin as he's otherwise known, is a bottom-living animal. He sits on the bottom of the ocean on rocks, and he likes to eat the common kelps or ringuringu. And they grow about a half an inch a year in diameter, and from about the fourth year on, they start producing roe, which is the most commonly eaten bit. And this is eaten all over the world with different sea urchins. When they start producing gonad or roe, they are spawning. They are capable of spawning, and the size of this roe increases in the summer months, or in the spring and summer months, and it reaches a maximum just before spawning. And when the roes are ripe and pulpy, then the urchins are ready to spawn, and that is the time when they are the fattest. It's been shown all over the world, and it's also part of my study, is to show that they produce the most roe on certain food conditions, and one of these is when there's plenty of kelp for them to eat. They also grow fastest on when they've got plenty of kelp. There's a complicating factor in this, in that the kina don't settle very well in areas where there's lots of kelp. They settle in areas away from the kelp. So while you might find a very few, very large, very fat kina in a big kelp forest, there won't be many there. However, on a area where there's lots and lots of small kina and not much kelp, because they eat it all out, they won't produce much fat. So there's a trade-off between the amount of growth and roe they can do, and the number of urchins that you can get in an area. This is very much of interest when it comes to conservation, and knowing when and where the best situations are for the kina and how they can be best looked after.
Is it possible to farm the kina?
At this stage, no. But I believe that they could well be farmed in the future. I don't think it will happen until it becomes economic to farm them. That seems to be the way of the world in this particular country.
I know you're a gun diver, Michael. What's your attitude towards the use of modern equipment like aqualungs, spear guns and the like?
Well, quite frankly, I think taking anything to eat with an aqualung is murder, because such animals as crayfish and the paua and the kina are all so easy to catch just on snorkel. For my research purposes, I have to use aqualung. However, I don't take animals for killing with aqualung. I've never used a spear gun, and it wouldn't be fair for me to criticise other people, except for killing such fish as leather jackets or red muki with a spear gun, because they again are so easy to catch any other way. The red muki just sit there and look at you until spear fishermen have a fairly easy time of catching them. Most other fish, it's reasonably easy to catch with a line. I don't think that spearing them is absolutely necessary.
Mm-hmm. There's been talk about the possibility of kina becoming an exported sort of luxury food to Japan.
Mm-hmm. There's a problem there in that we are many thousands of miles away from Japan. I think, for a change, this is to our advantage. There is a very heavy or very intense fishery for the Californian kina, where divers are taking up to a ton a day each and getting $200 for it. This was 2 years ago. And there was a processing industry aimed specifically at the Japanese market. It's just starting to occur here now. There's a few trial shipments going to Japan. I would hope that the government would recognise that this is occurring and act positively to control exploitation of the kina, so that New Zealand needs a serviced first, and that any development of a kina export industry would be controlled and managed.
It's been said, Michael, that the entire approach to seafoods by those in power is one of commercialism, where plundering stops only when depletion becomes a reality. The Maori people have always been the casualties here. Well, what are your views?
Well, for want of any evidence to the contrary, I can only agree with it. It was a fact that came out over and over again at the seminar last year on fisheries for Maori leaders. Stocks that local coastal Maori people have been living off and heavily dependent on for centuries have just within the last few years been decimated. I'm afraid there can be no excuse for it.
Have you compared the knowledge you've gained at the university with the traditional knowledge of your elders? They have hundreds of years of combined research and observance passed down through the ages.
Well, I don't know that it's valid for me to make the comparison with the knowledge of my elders because I don't know it, and I have not been I have not been taught a lot of the knowledge that I know existed. However, I believe that they were based on sound observation, very astute observation in many cases, and sound practices aimed at conserving the resource and living within the resource so that such animals as the kina could go on providing food for generations.
Selwyn Mudu talking to Michael Walker.
One of the classic karakia of the Opoli tribe is Ruia Ruia. Many generations ago, the tribe lived on Murimotu, an island off North Cape. A war party arrived on the mainland to attack the Opoli. Their chief, Tumatahina, composed the karakia, in which he and his tribe performed all night. During this time, the tribe was busily plaiting a huge rope, stretching from the island to a rock on the mainland. And this is how the tribe was able to escape from the enemy. The nonchalant chanting deceived the attackers. By daybreak and low tide, the war party discovered that Tumatahina and his people had deserted the island Murimotu. He compared his tribe with a kuaka, the godwit, a sacred bird and a delicacy of the tribe. Here is a proverb pertaining to the kuaka. Ko te kaupapa waka ki te moana hoiai, ko te kāhui atua ki te rangi rereai. Whilst the fleet of canoes over the ocean are paddled, the flocks of gods are above in the heavens flying. Here now is the karakia. Ruia, ruia, opea, opea, tahia, tahia. Kia he moa ke ko te kā, kua, kua. Kia here amai ki te pū koro ki, whakatataki mai nei tana pū, koro, whaikaro. He kua ka marangaranga, he kua ka marangaranga. Ko tahi te manui tau ki te tāhuna, tau atu, kua tau mai. Single file, let us not be scattered. Let us not be plundered by our foe. The kuaka lifts its head to the incoming tide. One has risen and flown, another has risen and flown. The rest will follow.
That ends tonight's program, so until next week, heiko nā rā.